From a look at a modern take on one of the original smartwatches, that's an automatic chronograph, to an actual new smartwatch with far-reaching implications and some American-only titanium that has me wishing the currency conversion to CAD was in my buying favor, this past week has had plenty of great watch news, and you know what? We're here for it. Give me that theme so we can get to the goods. It's Hodinkee Radio, and I'm James Stacey. Today, we're chatting on the latest from the lineage of the Apple Watch, Danny's recent spin with a classically-minded Zenith chronograph, and the latest drops from AP and, you know, whatever else we can cram into the next hour or so. To go over it all with me, please welcome my panel of esteemed colleagues. First up, he's the Hodinkee Renaissance man, a wealth of surprises, delights, and no small measure of mystery. It's our fave, brave EIC, Jack Forster. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks, James.
And rounding out this disparate triptych, it's the watch spotter extraordinaire, the Space Jam whisperer, and our watching movies maven, Danny Milton. How we doing, Danny?
We're doing well. I will never, ever, ever lose the Space Jam moniker, it seems.
Well, you know, give me some time. I have to write a different intro every time we do an episode. and I try and keep them kind of flowery. So I'll run out of interest with Space Jam at some point. I mean, I ran out of interest with Space Jam some 20 years ago. But, you know, you and I don't live on the same Space Jam plane.
I'd say that's true.
So this was kind of an exciting week for watches and for kind of watch enthusiasm. I think we'll start in sort of a no man's land from my standpoint, and that's with the new Apple Watch. You know, I'm an Apple user. I have an Apple phone, an iPhone. I'm recording this on a MacBook, but I've never really been an Apple Watch guy. You know, I've been a Garmin user for a really long time. But Jack, you know, the Apple Watch is actually something that even in my mind, even if you hadn't written the coverage of the new Series 7, it's a watch that I kind of attribute to you because you're kind of one of the few like big voices and authorities in the watch space that seems to have a genuine usable appreciation for this watch that doesn't come with any caveats. It always seems like if you have a smartwatch and that's what you really like to wear sometimes, you make excuses for it. Where do you stand on the Apple Watch, and what do you think of the 7?
You know, well, first of all, I think that it's kind of hilarious that just as Danny will always be Space Jam guy, I'm probably always going to be Apple Watch guy, at least to a certain extent, for precisely the reasons that you've outlined. I mean, I don't know, James. You know, it's been out, the Apple Watch has been out in one form or another since 2015. It came out about the same time I joined Hodinkee, actually. I'm sure there's no causal connection.
No.
and like everything else that you know, comes out in the technology world, the first iteration, I think, had some obvious, rough corners that needed to be rounded off, no pun intended about the case design. And that's kind of what Apple's been doing. You know, it's since the Series 1 came out, it's really been about evolution rather than revolution in a lot of respects. You know, with Series 6, the only really new thing we got, I think, was the blood oxygen sensor, the VO2 max sensor. But the user interface continues to improve. And, you know, now with the Series 7, what we have is something that it doesn't sound like a major difference on paper, but I think it's probably going to make a big difference to the user experience. The screen's quite a bit larger now. There's room for 50% more text. Apple's tweaked the thickness and geometry of the crystal so that it's more shatterproof. And the case is now officially dustproof, as well as having the same water resistance as the Series 6. So I think that it's not, you know, it's going to be easier to use because there's more screen real estate, easier to look at. But it's, you know, it is true that one of the things I said in the story was that you really do have to kind of wear the Apple Watch every day to kind of get what it has to give. As an occasional piece to sort of have in the rotation, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really offer that much. And it's, I don't think that it really feels like something that is intended to be a workouts only watch either, although you can certainly use it that, for that. You know, it wants to be part of your daily life. And that means if you're a watch enthusiast, it means double wristing or not wearing a mechanical watch at all if you're uncomfortable with double wristing, which is not everybody's cup of tea.
Right. Yeah. I came to smartwatches, like I said, through Garmin, and I do agree that you get the most out of these when they become your kind of only watch in many ways, or at least get that prime real estate. I typically wear one more for almost like a modern tool watch. So if I'm going running or biking or diving or whatever, that's when I would typically grab it. And otherwise, I typically only grab a smartwatch, the Garmin or whatever, like when I know my work schedule is so busy that I need an assistant to keep me on the calendars and the replies and the rest of it. So it is handy when you're traveling or when you just have a really busy scene. You know, I had always kind of taken to wearing them when we were covering things at weird time zones, simply because you weren't going to ever miss a message if it was buzzing at you from multiple devices. Danny, are you any interest in the smartwatch world, Apple Watch experience, any of that kind of stuff? Or is it a kind of like nice but not needed for you?
I've been in the Apple ecosystem since probably 2003 firmly, and yet somehow I've never really been interested in the Apple Watch, maybe because I'm afraid that I might like it too much.
It's going to be too handy.
I think so. I mean, I had a funny conversation recently with somebody who doesn't have one, is thinking of getting one, and the rationale was, it's just way easier than checking my phone, which is always it was a funny thing, because generally speaking, the whole argument against watches for people, mechanical watches, is, well, I just check my phone to tell the time. So it's almost like bizarre now we're going from, I check my phone to tell the time, to, that's a little bit too much. I'd rather just check my wrist to check everything. And I get it. I just, I'm afraid something is going to sort of take the mechanical objects off my wrist.
There might be an interesting story in that idea of, like, I've been afraid to try an Apple Watch or a smartwatch, and I gave it a month, and this is what I've come back. And as long as it's not a resignation letter, like, all right, well, I don't need to do watches anymore. This is actually peak watch, and just most of you don't get it. They can be super handy.
Who will rise up and become Mr. Space Jam if Danny leaves us for smartwatches?
I will definitely have a Space Jam Apple Watch face. That's for sure.
Oh, there you go. Well, I mean, hey, base is covered, right? You gotta mix and match all your interests, keep them together. You know, Jack brought up another topic that I think is an interesting thing, because I've even seen it outside of the mechanical plus an Apple Watch or smartwatch. It's this idea of double wristing. And I think, to be honest, the only person I've ever seen pull it off is Jack. So I think we might actually have the kind of preeminent double wrister in the space here. Jack, do you get any heat for wearing both? Like, because you've got an Apple Watch. I can't tell, your camera might be reversed, but I think that's on your left hand.
Yeah, it is.
And then do you typically wear the Apple Watch on your left? And then if you've decided to go with both, it's the mechanical watch on the right?
Actually, I'm not wearing a mechanical watch right now, just because I've been sitting at my desk for a couple of hours at this point. And often I don't wear a mechanical watch, especially on a bracelet, when I'm working from home, because the bracelet tends to bang against the desktop or bang against my keyboard. So even if I'm only wearing a mechanical watch, a lot of the time I actually use it as a desk clock when I'm, typing, which is what I do for a living, apparently. I usually wear the Apple Watch on my right wrist and a mechanical watch on the left wrist. It just feels more natural to me, although I have seen people do it the other way around. It's funny, nobody really gives me a hard time about it. There were some people, very early on when we started covering the Apple Watch, and when I started conspicuously double wristing and showing up at events like that, and saying that that's what I was doing on the site, there were people who gave me flack about it. It was sort of seen as some sort of basic betrayal of the fundamental tenets of watch enthusiasm. But I mean, I've seen people with super, super high end collections doing the same thing.
We
do seem to be a slightly older group of people who double wrist. I think maybe because we're, the older you get, the more you start to worry about all those little health things that you didn't have to worry about, in previous decades.
Another side of it might be that as you get a little bit older, and I'm not saying old, just a little bit older, you maybe care a little bit less about what the general crowd is saying about anything that you do. I've experienced that a little bit into my 30s, I think there's something to be said for, I don't really care what you think about what I wear at all.
Yeah, I actually am working on a fairly long drawn out story. I won't give away the title or too much of what it says, because it's one of those think pieces that people are either going to sit through or not. But it is basically about kind of getting to a point where you really just don't care what other people think, and I have the luxury, I think, of feeling that way. And it's partly from, just decades of exposure to, watch enthusiasts, watch enthusiasm, watch collecting and all that jazz. You do kind of end up, liking what you like for your own reasons, and to heck with what anybody else thinks, just as a, I think it just happens naturally. Speaking of rounding off rough edges.
My new nickname on YouTube is Nerd. That's a good one.
Let's be fair. That's pretty tame for YouTube.
That's extremely tame for YouTube.
I'll take it.
I mean, the thing is like, if people were simply calling you by your name, that would be better than nerd.
Sure.
But anything I've been called on YouTube that wasn't my actual given name is way worse than nerd, for sure. You know, the funny thing is I think there is some sort of crowd mentality to the perspective surrounding smartwatches. And while my gut reaction is always a Dan Harmon-esque, your booze me nothing to me, I've seen what makes you cheer.
That's a great way to put it.
We saw it on the comments for the Apple 7 post, people saying that it's not a watch. Where do you guys land on this? I'm happy to weigh in, but I would love to know where you guys land. Is the Apple Watch a watch in anything more than the way that Apple calls it a watch?
Well, I mean, it's. I think people say the Apple Watch is not a watch for the same reason that people say they hate date windows. You know, I mean, it's a way of drawing a line in the sand that kind of helps you define who you are. And you know, enthusiast communities are like this, right, guys? I mean, you know, we define ourselves as much by what we reject as by what we love. So, I mean, it's obviously a time-telling device that does other things and also sits on your wrist. And if the Apple Watch is not a watch, then, you know, neither is a multifunction, you know, G-Shock or a Garmin or, you know, what have you. And we're perfectly comfortable with calling those watches. So I think it has more to do with defining yourself by what, and you know, there's nothing wrong per se with this. This is what enthusiast communities do, as I said. But I think that it is, even the people who say it, I think that if you had them alone in a room and not in the comments and, you know, plied them with a couple of whiskeys or whatever their beverage of choice is, they probably would admit that it's not a particularly meaningful distinction definitionally. It doesn't say anything about what the Apple Watch is or what it does or doesn't do. What it does do is say, I don't like the Apple Watch, and it represents everything that I reject when I accept mechanical watches. Mm-hmm.
I think it stems from the same fear that I touched on before. It's just a fear of acceptance of that, because there are G-Shocks that read text messages from your phone via Bluetooth. I mean, and those are unquestionably watches to the same people that are calling the Apple Watch not a watch.
Right.
I think it's clear that the Apple Watch has taken a sizable portion of the watch market, if not like the majority of it at this point. And that the way that it's risen so quickly, I think just has people, you know, backpedaling and not knowing exactly what to do about it, especially enthusiasts like myself who are afraid that I'll like it too much. I mean, that's a genuine fear.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that we see it in the you know, my other big obsession is cars, which isn't necessarily shared by the two of you at a really high level, I don't think. So we don't have to go too deep. But you see this with people who like cars that really only an enthusiast could love, things that are difficult to drive and loud and smelly and dirty and break all the time, versus a Tesla. And they're like, well, but that, you know, not only does that not even have a motor and burn fossil fuels or whatever, like, you know, old dinosaur juice, but like it doesn't have the same sort of soul. And I think maybe that's what people are pointing at when they say the Apple Watch isn't a watch. And I don't buy it because, in my opinion, you wear it on your wrist and its primary thing that it does is tell you the time. In my mind, that's a watch. But I do understand that, you know, this is something where there'll definitely be people listening to this episode that are kind of like, why are you guys talking for 9 minutes about the Apple Watch?
and counter.
But let's be clear, we cover the watch industry and this is arguably the biggest watch in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but to your point, James, about cars that are, you know, expensive and troublesome to own, troublesome and difficult to drive, and are sort of a rolling advertisement for all of the, you know, negative effects of fossil fuels on the environment. You know, there's an essay by, I'm giving away the whole story. There's an essay by William Gibson from, I think, right around 2000 that talks about this idea, but, you know, in the context of mechanical watches. And I quote it in the story that I'm, you know, broadly hinting about. And he talks about something that he calls the Tamagotchi gesture. And, you know, Tamagotchis were those little LCD screen toys that, you know, you had to take care of a virtual pet or it would die on you. And
I just bought two of them. They're back.
Are they back? Really?
Oh. Yeah, my kids have both got them.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Are they wrist wearable?
No. And they don't have a clock per se. They have the animal. Nobody's, man, we're talking about if we were dividing the audience with Apple Watch. Now that we're into Tamagotchi, technically there's a clock that the animal follows so it knows when to go to bed or wake up.
Right.
And you can adjust that clock so that it's not bothering your kid when they're supposed to be sleeping or doing something else.
Gotcha.
But no, it's not. Its primary function is a tiny digital animal that you care for.
Yeah. So to just sort of like put a bow on it, you know, his idea was exactly the same point that you just made, which is that, you know, part of the attraction with mechanical watches, especially vintage ones, is that they require some care and thought in ownership. And I think there's something to that. Also, there's like, you know, I feel like we kind of answered this already, but have either of you guys ever tried double wristing for any length of time? Danny, it doesn't sound like you have.
I mean, I wear a digital Timex for fitness purposes, but I've never had the need to double wrist that watch with a watch of mine. Though I have seen people single wrist double watch by putting a digital watch on the underside of like a NATO somehow, or some kind of fabric strap where the mechanical watch is on the top of your wrist and like a small Casio is on the bottom.
It's kind of like that "Mom, I want this" meme, and "No, we've got this at home." It's the Breitling with the UTC module on the strap, and you're like, "No, we have Breitling at home," and it's a it's your watch with a Timex grafted onto the bottom of it.
Yeah, the industry experimented with the whole idea of smart straps for a while. I mean, you know, some fairly major, you know, large footprint luxury brands, but they don't seem to have gone anywhere.
No, I think people like to change their straps. And I think that the fitness tracking thing, the price dropped so quickly, so much faster than you would expect technology pricing to drop, where suddenly, you know, we were paying a certain amount for Fitbits, and then you're paying a certain amount for the next product. And then the Apple Watch came out at a price that people were really comfortable with. And it made this whole market kind of bottom out, where you could buy a Xiaomi Mi Band for $35. And not only did it tell you the time and vibrate when you got messages, but it did the step counting and the rest of it. And now you've got, you know, talk about a saturated market, the fitness tracker. But I think that's the only time where I've double wristed is I've worn a fitness tracker on one wrist and a watch on the other. And then I've had scenarios where I was traveling and I didn't want anything in a bag or a pocket, and I had more than one watch on me, and I slipped it on and, you know, kept it under a cuff, that sort of thing. But not with any like day-to-day intent, no.
You know what I found the Apple Watch really, really useful was at trade shows, you know, because...
I can imagine.
You know, you have half an hour for an appointment, and unless you can, I don't know, what's the Dungeons and Dragons equivalent of teleportation? Unless you can cast a blink spell or something, you're not going to get instantaneously from one appointment to the next. So by the end of the day, you know, especially running around someplace like Baselworld. Remember Baselworld?
No.
You know, where there could literally be half a mile between one appointment and the next. You would always end up running late. And just getting reminders on the watch was actually super, super useful for staying on time and on schedule.
Yeah, my thing was always just to stay near Steven. he had it.
Yeah.
He knew all the pieces, and I Steven's moving. I got to move. I'll talk to you later. Two steps behind Steven is how I didn't miss Baselworld appointments.
right.
Keep it easy. Man, trade shows. RIP. Back someday soon.
I hope so.
Yeah, Danny, we got to get you out there. And
I got to get somewhere.
You got to have the fun of the 20-hour days and the endless ramblings at night when you're trying to write your third piece and everybody's kind of lost their mind and I've had too much whiskey and, you know, the normal.
That's what I'm here for.
But yeah, that's someday we'll get back to it. But the Apple Watch is the Apple Watch. And now we have another version. And like you said, Jack, that kind of it's more of an evolution than a revolution. There was a lot of rumors that they were going to change the whole case structure was going to be more like the current iPhone. And they didn't go that way. You know, it's a more of a massaging of the dimensions of the various elements. And then I saw it looked like the edge of the screen now kind of curves.
Yeah.
So it looks like a little bit more like a modern smartphone pickup. But, you know, Jack, I don't think anyone, or at least I don't think we've seen these in person. Are you planning to get one in and give it a run?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you upgrade to the new one when it's available?
Yeah. I mean, not every iteration, but it's kind of a fun thing and not a relatively expensive thing to came up with. I mean, you know, $399 amortized over, you know, every couple of years is, it's probably less than my mechanical watches cost. Actually, it's probably a lot less than my mechanical watches cost.
Significantly less than mechanical watch budgets, for sure. Speaking of somewhat more expensive mechanical watches, Danny, you recently did one of our premium products, the A Week on a Wrist series with a Zenith chronograph. You want to tell us about that and how it went?
Yeah, I did A Week on the Wrist with the Zenith Chronomaster Original, the El Primero, with the classic tricolor, you know, aesthetic that everybody knows that watch to be. It's basically a modern iteration of the classic A386 watch from 1969. This is a watch that I've always loved from afar, any of the sort of El Primero-esque watches that Zenith has iterated on over the last, I don't know, two or so decades. And I think Cole wrote the intro piece back in June when it was released, and just knowing that a 38mm Zenith in that kind of classic look was out there was really intriguing. And I kind of jumped at the chance to be able to get it in and play around with it. And yeah, it was what we did was we took it into classic car, a 1966 Ford Mustang, trying to pair it with something of the era of the original A386. So that watch was from 69, close enough with 66. We tried to find a car from 1969. For all those out there who don't know how hard it is to produce a video of this magnitude, I know these are short videos, but there's a lot that goes into them. Things happen, such as the morning that you want to pick up said car from 1969, that it just starts leaking oil and you can't drive it because it's completely out of commission, needs to go see a mechanic. So you scramble to find another car within 2 hours.
What was the car that had to be replaced?
It was a Mercedes. I would need to consult which exactly Mercedes it was. We were trying to find a BMW from the era. Another fun fact, myself, Mr. Milton cannot drive stick. So we were looking for classic cars that were automatic, which was also like shrinking the pool of available automobiles that we could draw from.
True. Yep.
I feel like admitting that you drove a vintage car that had an automatic transmission on Houdinki radio is kind of like admitting that you double wrist with an Apple Watch. It's like, that's so off brand.
I know. It is off brand, but also it was on, to me, it was a little bit on brand for the watch because it was like this classic iteration that had such like modern capability to it. So for me, having a classic car with an automatic transmission was kind of similar to that in a lot of ways.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, we should get you into a stick car. Maybe Cole can give you a lesson around a racetrack somewhere. It is fun. But it is, I guess, I don't know, you know, this is again off topic. I have no idea what the take rate in 66 was on a Mustang between automatic and manual. My guess is the number might be kind of surprising. There might have been quite a few automatics, but... Yeah, so the video I thought was excellent, and you've got a 911 in the background for the kind of two camera segments. I wanted to do a little bit of like behind the scenes because I think, you know, we've probably done 50 plus a week on the wrist, probably more with video and stuff, right? What goes into the, you know, 9-10 minutes of video?
A lot. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of planning that goes in. We have an amazing video team that is responsible for organizing all of these sort of high-level shoots that we do, whether it's week on the wrist or talking watches, three-on-three, you name it. They do so much of the heavy lifting that we don't do. We come up with a lot of the high-level ideas, so it's easy for me to say, hey, guys, I'd love to drive a classic car all around. I'd love to sit in a really cool vintage coffee shop with a Porsche 911 behind me, all these things. But they're the ones who make it happen. There's a whole production schedule that we have that there's location scouting. Someone has to go find the car itself, rent it. But what ends up happening is there's a lot of adjusting to things that go wrong on every video shoot. It doesn't go as planned. It never does.
Yeah.
The locations you pick, the cars you pick, the script, and then after you film it, you find out that the audio is just shot because a refrigerator in the coffee shop was buzzing, but we couldn't hear it, you know, in the moment, which is what happened this time, you know?
Yeah.
We have audio engineers that do their best job to balance audio, so you never have to hear that those things ever happened. You know, if we have to record audio twice, things like that. I mean, it's like basic video production stuff. But on this particular shoot, when we found this Ford Mustang, which was honestly our second choice that we found on the day of, but turned out to be a great choice. You wouldn't know from looking at the video, but this was the hottest day of the year. There were 2 days in July that were 100 and 102 degrees back to back. On the 100 degree day, I was out on doing a magazine story on location. And then literally the following morning, I woke up at 7 o'clock to get into a car that has no air conditioning. Basically a sweat box that made it like 120 degrees. While our esteemed crew was driving around in a brand new air conditioned, you know, Toyota.
Sure.
You know,
for anything where you're speaking in the car, the windows have to be up for audio reasons too.
Completely up, which doesn't exactly help either because the engine is loud. So it wasn't like that was really like softening any of the audio issues. But yeah, windows have to be up. There were a lot of discussions going on in the air conditioned Toyota that I was not privy to as I was waiting in the air conditionless Mustang. And I would get out of the car a few times and was amazed at how much 100 degree heat felt amazing. You know, like
when
the
it's
difference
not
between
compressed.
What the temperature was in the car versus what the temperature was outside.
Yeah, you're in an oven.
It was incredible. And then as fate would have it, in the middle of the shoot, the car just overheated.
Yeah, sure.
And broke down as they're wont to do. And it was in that moment, I remember I had like two minds. I was driving in the car with one of our video producers, Shahed, and I remember saying to her, man, I get this classic car thing. I love these things. These are amazing. I could totally get into this. And then
yeah.
Not 30 minutes later, when the car broke down, I was like, no, I don't think this is for me. Because I think it's par for the course, to my understanding, is it just happens.
Yeah.
And if you're really into it, it's just part. It's part of the mystique. It's part of enjoying them. You know that you know stuff will happen with the car. And we had some great mechanics that came out, fixed the car up. We were able to get it back running. But yeah, we have some cool behind the scenes pictures of us just standing around a broken down car and seeing how we could salvage the rest of the day.
See if we can link some of those in the show notes. What did you think of the watch? The
watch was fantastic. I was pretty shocked by it. I'd never seen the 1/10 of a second chronograph function before in person.
It's rad, eh?
It's extremely cool. And what I like the most is that the watch still manages to be 38 millimeters and fairly compact and fairly slim. To me, that's the best, like the absolute like icing on the cake for it, because it feels so much like a vintage watch, which I often marvel like how they were able to ever get those kinds of mechanics into small watches. And yet today, so many of the pieces we see are upsized and a lot thicker and a lot heavier and just a lot less streamlined. And this was none of that. It was exactly what you'd want from a watch in any era. And it felt very faithful to everything that Zenith would have wanted to make in 1969. Nothing on it felt like a departure. It didn't feel like a throwback so much as it felt like the final version, you know, of what, right, of what that watch could be.
And aside from being part of a website that has to make content to continue being a website, why review this watch now? Is this a watch that you find personally interesting, you know, special beyond its, say, its price tag or its competition, that sort of thing?
I think, first of all, there was a newness to it, which definitely makes it worthy of conversation now. But beyond that, I still think that Zenith, for new enthusiasts, is a brand that is not well-known, not well-understood. You have, in terms of popular chronographs, you've got Rolex and Omega kind of ruling the world. And just right behind them is a watch that should be slotted right next to them. And I think that the El Primero deserves just as much notoriety as any famous Swiss watch ever made. I mean, it's just as iconic. It has as much historical value. And I think when a brand like Zenith releases sort of the perfect version of their most iconic watch, it's worthy of coverage anytime.
Right. You know, Jack, I'm curious what you think. Why do you think Zenith isn't necessarily in the same mindshare? Or maybe not just Zenith, but why the El Primero isn't necessarily as hot as a Daytona?
I think it's probably, I mean, there's probably a lot of things that factor into it. I mean, you know, it's the dumbest and least helpful tautology that you can formulate sort of in the watch world. But, you know, Rolex is Rolex. And by extension, Rolex is Rolex for a reason. So you have this massive, massive, massive kind of brand equity and brand recognition behind Rolex that, I mean, I would be willing to bet you that if you took 100, you just grabbed 100 people at random, a lot more of them would have heard of Rolex than have heard of Zenith. So you have this, you know, absolute tsunami of brand recognition behind the Daytona. You also have continuity of production of the Daytona as well. I mean, it's been in production, you know, consistently for decades, you know, without an interruption. Whereas the, you know, Zenith as a brand and in general and the El Primero movement in particular, you know, they packed up the pieces and that they needed to make it and stuck them in an attic, and it was an order from Rolex. Speaking of Rolex, that really put the movement back into production. And, you know, I mean, Omega is, it's not quite the marketing behemoth that Rolex is, but it has a huge, huge, huge sort of available mindshare to draw from. The Speedmaster is the moon watch, you know, and nobody ever is going to take that away from them unless, you know, we start sending people to the moon with something other than an Omega. So I think for all of those reasons and more, the Zenith El Primero is not accorded the recognition that it deserves from a technical and historical standpoint. I mean, I find it kind of fascinating that it's, you know, of the three automatic chronograph movements that launched in 1969, you know, the other ones being from Seiko and the, you know, Breitling Hamilton Hoyer Consortium, you know, it's the only one that's still in production. And, you know, you can have either the original version, you know, basically the original version unchanged, the Caliber 400, or you can have an updated version if that's what you prefer. I'm actually curious which one, if you had to choose between the two, which one would you go for? I mean, would you go for the, you know, sort of hardcore enthusiast, nostalgist's pick, you know, which is the EP400, or would you go for an updated version of the movement?
I'm thinking. I my gut's telling me the Caliber 400. Even though I was totally smitten by this watch, there's something magical, I think, about that movement, the story behind it, how it was kind of saved and morphed, and not only did it revive Zenith as a brand, but was able to help catapult Rolex to take the Daytona from kind of not necessarily its most popular watch to being arguably like the Rolex right now. Of course, we've talked about this a lot offline, Jack, but of course, Rolex made probably so many modifications that 50% of the movement, you know, was more Rolex than it was Zenith, but, you know, it was still springboarded off of that Caliber 400 movement. And I think just to have that original movement inside of an El Primero from Zenith would just be amazing to have.
And we're talking about it this many years later. You know, the thing that strikes me with Zenith that I don't think factors to Omega and Rolex, if we're going to use these three as the examples, is Zenith went through hard times. Aesthetically, leadership, you know, they really ebbed and flowed in terms of their perspective. The Rolex perspective is granite. I mean, it moves slowly, it barely changes. They really know what they want to do, and people have really attached to the fact that it's so glacial in its surprises. It, you know, it's hard to be surprised by something that takes that long to come to fruition and then never goes away. And I think in the same way we see that with the Speedy, like the Speedy had this amazing moment that they've respected. So it's two different kind of philosophies on enduring product design and legacy. But I think Zenith doesn't get to benefit from that. And I think that's where insiders know Zenith because they would know their history. But people kind of new to the space maybe wouldn't understand, one, why this is this much money. Why is it $3,000 or $2,000 more than a Speedy? What's special about it? And I think this comes down to sites like Hodinkee and our peers and stuff. I still think there's some explanations to be made about what 5 Hertz is and why it is something and why some brands are still about it.
Absolutely. I think at the same level, when you're looking at how much more expensive it is than a Speedy, it's also basically $5,000 less than a Daytona. And a point that I didn't necessarily drive home in the video, but it's true, is that it's hard, if not downright impossible, to get a Daytona, whether we're talking steel or precious metal. And a watch with just as much history and a history that's connected to Rolex in many ways is. And there's all manner of El Primero watches from Zenith, but things that are iterating off the A386, especially in the Caliber 400, I think you would be getting a whole lot of watch that anybody who knows watches or any collector, if you walked into a room, would get that sort of nod of approval with a Zenith.
The other one that I think is an interesting sort of very quiet elephant in the room is the fact that you mentioned it, that Seiko was part of this in 1969 and is not in this world currently. How badly does Seiko need a $2,000 to $3,000 like Prospects automatic chronograph? Is that a good idea or is that a terrible idea?
I mean, how badly do they need it commercially is a really, really good question. That doesn't seem to be where they perceive the center of gravity for the company to be.
It feels like we're right on the edge of it being too late for them to make a reissue Pogue or something like that that people could go crazy about.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that, I mean, I would certainly love that. And I think that there's probably a ton of people out there who would. But, you know, it just doesn't seem to be where they want to put their money. And they've got the money to put it there if they wanted to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if anyone could come out with a new automatic chronograph movement, or conceivably hand-wound, I guess, but probably automatic, it would make more sense, and make it happen for a price point that would absolutely challenge the ETA 7750s of the world, it would be Seiko. And it would be fascinating to see them do the same sort of treatment they gave to my beloved SPB143, which is just very, it's kind of a quiet, small, easily wearable. It's a little on the expensive side for enthusiast Seiko prices, but it's really not when you look into the rest of the market, what's out there.
I'd love for there to be, you know, another choice in terms of, you know, historically resonant, you know, mechanical chronographs. I mean, because it's not, especially if you're looking for an automatic chronograph, there's just not a whole lot of variety out there in terms of movement technology.
Yeah, at a certain price point, you're pretty much stuck with a 7750 or an offshoot thereof. And then once you've kind of broken through the sort of Zinn, Bell & Ross, Braymont price points, then you're right at a Speedy. And then from there, it goes insane. I mean, chronographs are still very strong in the five-figure world. It'd be great to see something in the four, very low fours, if we could.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
I feel like I say that a lot about all sorts of different stuff. Stuff should be cheaper. It's more fun when it is. So that really only leaves me with one sort of question. One thing I'd like your thoughts on when it comes to this Zenith. Where do you guys land on the 430 date? Don't care, hate it, like it, because it was there on the original.
I like it for that reason. And I also, I really don't get the sort of like hate the, I mean, I know that people come up with all sorts of reasons, quote unquote, why they hate the 430 date window. But I feel like there aren't really reasons for a lot of things that we say there are reasons for. I mean, certainly about watches in particular, and I think, you know, life in general, we have emotional reactions to things that are not based on reason at all. And then we kind of like backfill, quote unquote, reasons in order to justify our completely irrational take. And I kind of feel like that's where the 4:30 date window is. It's like, it's okay, you know, I mean, to not like it, but there's nothing, I don't think there's anything inherently bad about it from a design standpoint. It's no worse than having the date at 6 or the date at 3 or the date at 12, which is, you know, something that happens very, you know, relatively seldom, but looks kind of cool when, you know, when it happens. It doesn't bug me in the slightest. And it's, and in this case, it's kind of a signature of that particular watch and that particular movement. So I think it's cool.
I don't hate it either. I mean, it to me, especially on the tricolor variation, it kind of jives with the kind of wonky late 60s aesthetic. The watch couldn't have been less conservative at the time. You know, there's a ton of monochromatic watches out there, black dial, white dial, panda dial. We're talking about, you know, red and blue and sort of bright colors. And why not bolster that with a 4:30 date window? Just sort of like really lean into it. I'm not one that's going to say for the sake of historical accuracy, I like it because it's historical. You know, they very well, I guess, could have manufactured the movement with a date window at 3 o'clock from the jump. You know, that would be the argument if you want to argue that. But that's all to say they didn't. I mean, this is what they made. And so to that level, no, I don't hate it. I don't hate a lot of things. You know, hate's a really strong word. It's not something that jumps out at you when you're wearing the watch either. Like, trust me, it absolutely does not, especially when you're talking about a watch that's 38 millimeters in diameter. And it's sort of in line with the 100 seconds counter. It's right there. You know, all the numerals are sort of offset as they, you know, circumvent. And, you know, it's there are worse things on watches than this 4:30 date window. Many, many worse things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on record. I hate 4:30 dates, you know, almost without exception. I think it's a little bit different when you get into a chronograph because they are busy enough to make that date not feel like they got 95% of the way through designing the watch, and then they went, oh crap, the movement has a date? All right, punch a hole in the dial and let's keep going, right? Like the one on the El Primero, it does bother me when I look at it in images, but then if I have that watch in person, it doesn't bother me at all, like even a little bit. And I think the cool thing in my mind is this is one of the few where I would give it a pass, where it wouldn't bother me. It's almost like, if you guys remember, just for traditional reasons, Saab, the car maker, used to have their ignition kind of between the passenger and the driver down in the center console. And that would be annoying the first four or five times you got in your new Saab and jammed the key into the steering column or whatever. And of course, now cars all just have a button that you press. But back in the day, I think there's a little bit of charm to that, in that it's quirky, you know. And I think that kind of works in Zenith's favor, as it does kind of stand out. I think that a no-date version would also be really hot. I don't think it would be better to just go, we didn't like it at 4:30, so we moved it to 6. Like, keep the 4:30 because it's old school and cool and kind of funky and weird. But I think a no date version of that watch, especially, in Danny, you pulled this one out in the video, the gold one. I swooned pretty hard for that gold one.
It's awesome. I mean, Zenith has done this with no date options before, the Revival series. I think the Revival Shadow is one of the coolest watches out there. It's very cool.
Is that the one in the 384 sort of inspired case?
Yes.
Yeah, that's sweet.
And there's no date. There's others like the Revival Liberty and a lot of others in that range that do have the date. So I could see that coming from Zenith maybe in the future. Who knows? It wouldn't be exactly as faithful, but it would still be as good.
I mean, one really, really obvious fact that it kind of amazes me that this isn't talked about more, but there really isn't any other place to put the date window on that watch. I mean, you know, the one that you reviewed in Steel, for instance, Danny, like, you can't put the date window at 3 o'clock because there's no room for it. There's no room for it in between the chronograph subdial.
Right.
And the outer minutes track. You could put it at 12 o'clock, but that would, you know, that would look, that would just give people something else. It would be very strange.
That would be quite a bit stranger than 4:30.
You could put it at 7:30. That's pretty much the only other place on the dial that you could put the day. I'm just imagining people's reaction to a 7:30 date window.
Well, you guys remember the Gerard Perregaux www.tc? Mm-hmm. It had a date at 2 or 2:30?
Yeah,
some of the versions. Maybe it might have been because they made a lot of those. Those are very cool watches in my world. A little on the large side. A lot of them were like 44.
Yeah, they were big.
But really interesting movements. Gerard Perregaux, when they do sporty stuff, does it from an angle that like no one else can even think about. you look back at some of their, like, the Ford Ane chronograph and the stuff they did with Ferrari, because, you know, before Panerai, before Hublot, before all these other brands were tied with the Ferrari name brand, believe it or not, or Jean Perrigo, the watch, you know, pre-internet watch world was very interesting in its connections because they were all niche. They didn't have to appeal to a worldwide audience that had Instagram and the rest of it. But some of the weird older GP stuff is really rad, and I'm almost positive that they did a like a I'll put it in the show notes if I can find it, but www.tc that had, it was a chronograph and a world timer, and it had a date like around 2 or 2:30, which is plenty wild.
Yeah, I'm kind of I'm remembering the same thing. Yeah, it really is funny though. I'm surprised that, you know, the placement of the 4:30 date window on this particular watch, you know, isn't talked about a little bit more just from a practicality standpoint, because, you know, like I'm looking at the dial right now. And yeah, I mean, there's no really is kind of the best place to put it if you're going to have a date on that watch that size with that chronograph subdial configuration at all. I mean, you can't actually put it to 12 o'clock either, because then you would have to rearrange all of the dial verbiage and change the location of the, I think it would throw everything off.
I think Jack swayed me. I think just the sheer idea that there's nowhere else to put it makes it, it's a great argument, and it makes it honestly more thoughtful. I mean, you're looking at it and you go, where would we put it?
Yeah, Jack, you know, I think your where else would they put it argument is kind of fun for the El Primero and the 4:30 date. Let us know in the comments what you think of 4:30 dates, whether it be on this watch or another one. Tell me your favorite and your least favorite, and we'll go from there. And maybe we'll start to zero in on the perfect placement or the ways in which a 4:30 date can actually work. All right, I think that's enough of lowly $8,000 chronographs and where they decide to put their dates. I want to talk about the high life, the good life, the big dresses, the weird colors, the famous people who I've never heard of, and that would be the Met Gala. Did you guys scope this article we published, which was like a watch spotting from the Met Gala? Danny, did that come from your watch spotting talent? It probably did, didn't it?
It wasn't just mine. I crowdsourced internally from the good folks at Hodinkee, including Trevor, who is our esteemed social media coordinator, who also is a great watch spotter and was following along the red carpet. But yeah. That was my name is on that story.
Right. So what do you, let's start there. What, for those listening, I'm not a New Yorker, obviously, even a little bit. What is the Met Gala and why does it matter? Let's start there. Because I think, you know, we have a big enough audience that's probably not necessarily tied into why we would even publish this.
The Met Gala is, what's the formal name for it? I think it's the Costume Institute Gala or something like that. It's a benefit for the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Costume Institute, and
okay, you know,
historically it's been there's a theme which is announced by the organizers every year, and you know, sometimes people get with it and sometimes people don't. From some of the reviews from the fashion press that I read of this year's Met Gala, I think there was a feeling that this year's theme was kind of harder for people to wrap their minds around. But, you know, there have been, I think one major snafu I remember was when the organizers decided that the theme was going to be a white tie. And, you know, nobody knew what that was. So there were all sorts of hilarious attempts to approximate, you know, what people thought was some vague notion of, you know, super formal dress. The men always seem to go for variations. You know, if you're a guy and you're going to the Met Gala, you don't have a whole lot of options unless you want to really, really go off the reservation. You know, I mean, you either dress up in a way that looks, you know, kind of bizarre and is going to, you know, get your picture in as many publications as possible, or you just say screw it and you put on a tux.
Yeah, you put a tux on and you brush your hair, or you carry around a weird baby, a weird green baby like Frank Ocean. Right. And I love Frank, so you're not going to hear anything but love and appreciation. I'm sure Frank knew what he was up to.
That green baby actually showed up in a dream that I had the day after I saw the MetLife coverage. So I woke up and I was like, it took me like 15 minutes to figure out why there had been a weird green baby in that dream. And I was like, then I looked at the Met Gala coverage and I was like, oh, that's why.
All right. Well, we don't have to belabor this because it is a very much a visual sort of post. It's a watch spotting, a mix of very well-dressed people and people who maybe are well-dressed and I just don't have appreciation for high fashion. That's fine, of course. What stands out as far as some of the watches that we saw on the list? Danny, any of these are faves for you?
Yeah, there was obviously a lot of interesting watches there. Weirdly for me, the one that stood out was a watch on someone that is not known for wearing watches, and that's the Tonight Show host Jimmy Fallon. He was, there was actually a funny bit on the James Corden show where the two of them, he was talking about a conversation they had at the Met Gala where the two of them looked at each other and said, "You and I are the only two people here who actually just put on a black tuxedo." Whereas everybody else, to Jack's point, was dressed all manner of crazy things. But what Fallon had on his wrist was an Omega Speedmaster Mark II, but a vintage model from 1972, which is a crazy watch, first of all. He did a little behind-the-scenes video on his own Instagram where not only did he show the watch he was wearing, but he had a nice close-up photo of it. And he also told the audience he was wearing Cartier cufflinks that belonged to David Letterman. So it was kind of a cool homage to, you know, the last generation of late-night television hosts, and a great vintage watch, which is definitely not, you know, tuxedo appropriate. I'm sure our audience would agree, but at the Met Gala, I think anything kind of goes.
I also think, I'm not saying that Jimmy Fallon is necessarily like a maven of style, but I think that his entire like arc has just been like, I'm doing this because it makes me happy.
Yeah, definitely.
So like, I don't think you're going to question Fallon deciding to wear a Speedy instead of a beautiful Page Altiplano or something like that, like you might more commonly see at these things. Jack, any of these stand out for you, or are you also in the Fallon and the Speedy camp?
I mean, I think that was a great choice. I think he looked fantastic, but I got to give a shout out to friend of the show, Aldous Hodge, for rocking
the Grubel 4Z. Yes, this is my pick.
Yes.
Yeah, that Grubel 4Z double tourbillon 30 degrees is, I think it's one of the most beautiful watches ever made. The last time I actually had my hands on one, I think was like, I did a story on it back in like 2016 or 17, I think. I'm sure that we can find it. But it's just an astonishingly beautiful watch. If you like their approach to watchmaking at all, I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces that Grubel 4Z's ever made. And, you know, you can just get lost in it. And I think he looked fantastic. I mean, very, very clean.
Oh, he looks like $1 million. The watch always, like, it's a GF. It always looks like $1 million, regardless of what they're billing for it. No, absolutely. I mean, he got the top photo in there. I mean, aside from the Hero, which is a sick G-Shock. Hmm. But yeah, I thought Hodge won for sure. It looks so good.
Yeah, just his whole look overall, you know what I mean? And he's not only a watch enthusiast, he's also a watchmaker. Yep. So I don't think that it's unreasonable to assume that he really kind of, to some extent at least, built his look around what would make him look good, but also, you know, what would kind of set off the watch nicely. And he just looked fantastic, I thought.
Yep, no, I absolutely agree. It was an interesting post. You know, I find the Met Gala to be baffling, but it happens. And I guess you get these crazy looks and the wild dresses and the rest of it. And hey, I'm sure there's things that I'm into that other people would look on and go, yeah, I don't know what's going on here. Why these people are congregating all in one place. But hey, if it's supporting a good group of people, then more power to them. We'll put that in the show notes if you didn't catch it. And yeah, I would say kudos to Fallon and to Aldous for some great picks and some solid looks. I think we got to wrap up, but I really don't want to go. I don't want to miss my chance to talk about a watch that I'm excited about, which is this. AP made a handful of drops recently, but one of them is a US only titanium QP. The Royal Oak QPs are for me, that's where the Royal Oak, that's what it is in my mind. I wrote a huge story last year about kind of the early years of the Royal Oak QP and how, in many ways, it is as strange a watch. It's not as big a gamble, but I would say it's as strange a watch move as the original Royal Oak was in 72 to then come out, you know, right on the edge, right when most brands were disappearing, to say like, oh, we're actually going to take our arguably most difficult watch to make and our most difficult movement to produce quickly and put it in one case that's like crazy thin, and it's still going to be water resistant. And we're going to continue to make it in steel. And for so long, they were slept on. And I think they're starting now. They're 41 millimeters. They're a little bit bigger. In person, they're really incredible things. And they're like a touch point in my mind for like high-end watchmaking that I think I would actually want on my wrist for more than a few hours at a time. A lot of this stuff that you look at, you go, well, that would be amazing to wear for a little while. Then you actually think of owning it and you're like, oh my goodness, the door jams, a door jam that could cost me $20,000, or, you know, I'd have to put my kids in a different room and you know, just cut wall to wall mattresses and go full Howard Hughes to make sure I don't put a scratch on something more fancy. But with these, and even with the titanium, I just think like, what a, What a cool thing. You know, it's fun to see more of these, more titanium in general. It's already been a pretty good year for the metal in general. Where do you guys land on this or any of the other? There's been a handful of like very recent drops from AP.
For the QP, I happened to conveniently pop into the office when it was in for photography and got to try it on. Titanium still like baffles me. Like my mind can't grapple like how what I'm holding to what I'm looking at. Like the math doesn't work. Like it looks heavy, feels light, like unreasonably light. And I honestly think if I were to choose, I mean, not that I have the budget for it, but if there was a Royal Oak for me, it would be a titanium Royal Oak, and it might very well be this QP. I mean, it was like nothing I'd worn before. And I've worn some stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's $80,000 if you can get one. So it's not like the titanium means that it's suddenly a screaming bargain.
Right.
You know, keep in mind that I saw five-digit versions of the previous generation, the 39 millimeters. I have auction records in my post of like solid gold BAs going for $10,000-$12,000. So it is an insane world that we exist in. But Jack, if you look at this, and then of course they did a repeater and a code 1159 openwork tourbillon. Where do you land on these three? What's the one that like really captures the Jack vibe?
The Royal Oak repeater.
It's a tough question.
Yeah,
because that repeater is crazy.
That repeater is fantastic. AP has such a long, wonderful history of doing minute repeaters. Mm-hmm. You know, so pretty much any minute repeater that you get from AP is going to be worth paying attention to. I don't know though. I mean, I think the perpetual calendar in a Royal Oak case is a really, really convincing complication. I think it just, and you know, you're absolutely right. It's kind of a strange move, you know, at first. I mean, if it had never been done before and somebody said, okay, well, like, you know, let's put this, you know, kind of austere, old school, you know, pretty traditionally constructed complication inside, you know, a case that was, you know, designed in the early 1970s. It, you know, on paper, it doesn't sound like it should work, but it works really, really well.
Yeah.
That said, I'd give my eye teeth to play around with that repeater for an afternoon.
Mm-hmm. And then this, you know, the code 1159, that's a watch that gets a lot of heat. I think this openwork tourbillon is the best looking one they've made yet. And in part, I would say it's because of that strap. And if you've no clue what I'm talking about, because you're not a code fan or you're not an AP guy or whatever, guy or gal, just hit the link in the show notes, because it's on this like a NATO, but a sewn strap. So a two piece sort of nylon textile strap of some sort. And I'm sure it's much fancier than a NATO. Let's be clear. That's just kind of my touch point for watch straps. That with the kind of darker tone of the metal and then this fully open worked, it's all very uniform in its effect. I think three incredible drops for sure.
If you can see one, I think it's really worth seeing this two-tone Code 1159 in person. I mean, there's the combination of a gold case metal with white metal, you know, everything else. It just works really, really well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not a big two-tone fan, but I do like the idea of just having it on. I guess it's the hands as well, but that center barrel element. Yeah, these are cool things, and it's cool to see it sort of progress towards some maturity in terms of having a position that we understand and how it looks. And of course it is just a fantastically finished watch, even by AP standards. Really impressive things, and I'm 100% in agreement with Jack. You should get a chance to see these in person whenever possible. So if you live in a city with a boutique, maybe give them a call and see what they've got that you could swing by and take a look if they don't mind. I think it's always a treat to see this kind of stuff. And if you're lucky enough to be in Danny's position and get to hold or try on a titanium Royal Oak, that's kind of a special moment in many ways.
It's all luck, though.
Yeah.
All luck of the draw.
Well, that's how most of these things go, but I'll take luck if it gets me a titanium Royal Oak every now and then. To everyone listening, thank you so much. Hit the show notes if you have any comments or if you want to read in more on some of the stuff we chatted about. Otherwise, we'll catch you in about a week's time, and we'll chat to you then. Thanks for coming on, guys.